So I think this stuff is among the most confusing stuff we do because it fights common sense so strongly. But in terms of kind of a review board sort of stuff, it all looks pretty simple. So the hard part is this centripetal acceleration, but it's not hard because of the formula, right? The formula is super simple. It's hard to remember that and believe that the acceleration is always pointing towards the center of the circle. And that the name of the game in these problems is typically given the acceleration to calculate some forces, knowing that the forces have to be causing this acceleration. So when something's going in a circle, there isn't a centrifugal force that's pushing you out. There's a centripetal force that's actually pushing things in. Things want to go in a straight line, and in order to twist them into a circle, something has to be constantly pushing them in. And usually that centripetal force is what you need to calculate as part of knowing that the motion is in a circle. The first part of that chapter, I hope, is easy. It just should remind you of what you did in chapter 2. So instead of having linear measurements, now we have angular measurements, and exactly the same equations apply. Exactly the same story, that velocity is the slope of position, and angular acceleration is the slope of angular velocity. And we can go up by finding the area under these curves. So all of the sorts of problems that we worked out linearly, we can now work out with angles. And fundamentally, the only difference is that we have Greek letters as opposed to Latin alphabet. And you don't have to use radians. The book seems to always want to convert things to radians. Often there is no necessity to do that. You can use revolutions, as revolutions per minute is probably the most common way of measuring the angular velocity. The one place you do have to use radians is when you use these relationships between distances around and angular stuff. So there's a relationship between the angular velocity and the tangential velocity. The further you are out, the bigger the radius, the faster the speed. And so it goes. Questions? So there are a whole lot of questions, kind of iQuiz sort of questions, that are perfectly designed to fool you up. So here are a couple of examples. So here we have a giant Ferris wheel, 40 meter diameter. It's got a cage, and the thing is turning so fast that the man in the cage feels like he has his normal weight, even though he's upside down. That is to say, the normal force is equal to his weight. So what's the net force? If it's accelerating, there has to be a net force, right? So A should be dead out. I haven't seen any right answers, but maybe I'm just not looking hard enough. Everyone's avoiding. I see one right answer. Mostly people are avoiding the right answer. So we're told that the normal force is mg, and of course he weighs mg, so the net force better be 2mg. That's what you had. Okay, so what's the net force when the man's at y? I see some right answers, but mostly wrong answers. So it can't be A, right? Because there's acceleration. If you're moving it, so this thing is going at a constant speed, so there's acceleration, so there has to be a net force. So it can't be A. Yeah, I like C. So whatever, if it's going at a constant speed, it's the same acceleration. If it's the same acceleration, it's the same force. The force is always pointing towards the center of the circle. So when it's at y, it's a net force of 2mg up. What's the net force when the guy's here? 2mg, right? It's 2mg all the time.
Does the direction just change depending on where the center is?
Yep, so the acceleration always points towards the center, and so the net force always points towards the center.
So can you go back to the top part? So he said that he feels his weight is what it normally is when he's just standing on the ground?
Yeah, so if he were standing, so he's up, yeah. So if he were standing on a spring scale, a normal bathroom scale,
yeah,
it would read his weight even though he's upside down.
So then
as in he would fall and hit his head at that point.
No, he's in this thing that's going around.
Oh, so like as if the square box was facing down, he's feeling that.
Yeah, so if he puts the bathroom scale on the ceiling,
okay,
and stands on it, it would read his weight.
So I guess then that would mean that the weight is going that way. So it would be going up against the scale.
There's nothing I can think of that's going up. So the normal force pushes down and gravity pushes down. There is no force pushing up.
But if you were to put a scale on the ceiling and then stand on it for the scale to record anything, something that'd be pushing against it. So wouldn't that be meaning that it's going up?
So it's true that if the normal force is pushing him down, he's pushing the normal force up. He's pushing the floor up. That's true. But that's not a force on him. That's a force that he is pushing on the scale.
Okay. It's all going down. I don't understand how he's standing upside down.
Yeah, so if everything's going down for that chalk at the top, how come it's not going down? So he is going down, just like that piece of chalk is. He's going up and over. And the force on him is down.
So are you trying to say that instantaneously at that exact moment, if you were to keep those forces, he would fall down, but since it's continuing motion, doesn't.
So if the force were always mg down, no matter where he was, then it would be just projectile motion like that. And you can think of this piece as being kind of like the top of the arc of such a situation. But by the time he's over here, that force is now pointing more like this. So instead of this being a parabola, it's a circle.
So you can say at every moment in the circle, he is at the top of his arc.
Say that again?
At every point in that circle,
No. So just the very top of this is similar to the top of a projectile.
Isn't the entire circle all the way around similar?
Yeah, but down here so gravity always points down, right? No matter where you are.
Right.
Whereas this force we've been talking about, currently it's pointing down, but if you move over a bit, it's going that away, and then it's going that away. It's always pointing towards the center of the circle. So the change in the direction of the force is different. If we look at a big enough piece of the circle, it starts to be significant. But if we look at just the very tippy top, it's not always exactly down, but it's pretty close to being mostly down. And so the motion here at the top is very similar to the projectile motion at the top of the arc. So there are lots of confusing questions about centripetal motion. So I will tell you that the one problem I remember when I took this course many years ago, the question I remember missing was a centripetal force problem where I had the direction wrong. It's very easy to get sucked into wrong directions. No centrifugal force, right? That's what your experience says. So if you make a left-hand turn in your car, the books go over against the right-hand wall. That's not because something pushed them that way. That's because the wall came and hit them. So if there wasn't any frictional force on those books, they would go in a straight line. And instead of going in a straight line, they intersect the wall of the car about there. So it's the wall that's hitting the books, not the books that are hitting the wall. So the frictional force on these books is what's pushing them around the corner if they're staying put. And since the frictional force has some maximum value, if you try and go around that corner fast enough, you'll overwhelm the centripetal force that the friction can apply, and the books are going to go against the wall. So you can delete that word centrifugal from your vocabulary. It refers to nothing that's real. You can delete the word inertia from your vocabulary. It refers to nothing that's real. Pretty useful words if you're talking to your 8-year-old sister, but.
If any of those problems are could we do a free body diagram? Just I don't know. When you say that word doesn't exist, what do you mean by that?
I appreciate that you didn't say it, because I don't like to hear that word. Okay, so say again.
Does that just refer to the acceleration direction? Or, so that force is actually not a force? Because, some of the problems that we had, it was we would set that equal to that times m equal to, mg. So, why is that if it's not a force?
Okay, so let's talk briefly about the exact problem that you're thinking about, and then we'll do another example after that. So, before class, I was asked about the amusement park ride, the big cylinder. And I'm sure you've all seen these. You're pinned against the wall, and there's no floor. So, what are we going to do? We're going to look for the forces. And we've got those list of forces, right? So we've got normal force. Normal force always pushes perpendicular to the surface. So there could be a normal force like that. Gravity, it always pushes down. Frictional force always has to be perpendicular to the normal force. So it could be any place parallel to the surface, but in a minute I hope to convince you that the frictional force is pushing up. But other than that, there are no springs attached. There are no strings attached. This has to be the whole list of forces. There is no other force present. You can see that there's an unbalanced force. Therefore, there has to be an acceleration. And there is an acceleration. This thing is moving in a circle. So this is not a force. This is an acceleration. And we know that F equals ma. So this normal force is causing the centripetal acceleration. If that normal force went to zero, you would go on a tangent. You wouldn't continue in a circle. It's that force that is constantly pushing you around in a circle. So Newton had the following argument to try and convince you about centripetal forces. He said, imagine that you were playing pool on kind of an octagonal surface. And you know that you could imagine a pool shot that would be kind of like that. And what's happening, of course, is that at every time it's hitting one of these bumpers, a force is pushing it that way. And motion in a circle is just like that, except with a huge number of sides. You're constantly being pushed towards the center. You want to go in a straight line. Something is pushing you around the corner. Okay, so there's no acceleration in the y direction, so you know that the sum of the forces in the y direction has to be zero. So we know what the frictional force is, we know what the normal force is, we can calculate the coefficient of friction because that's the ratio of the two. So why doesn't this work if the cylinder isn't rotating? Well, if the cylinder isn't rotating, there's no acceleration, so there's no reason to have a normal force, and then there's going to be no frictional force because it's a fraction of the normal force, and down you go. So by spinning it fast, we make a very large acceleration, which requires a very large normal force, which will then produce any size frictional force that you want.
So does A always kind of counteract one force that like doesn't have a, like in that case, like normal force didn't have a, to balance out? Is that usually where the acceleration is located?
So I kind of know what you're saying, but first thing I'm going to say that it's not fair to say that the acceleration balances a force because they're different things, right? You're comparing apples and oranges. Acceleration cannot be compared to a force. They have different units. But what is very typically the case is that we know the acceleration from the problem and we're going to calculate a missing force from that. So in the past, very typically problems have been find the forces and then calculate what the acceleration is. With these circular motion problems, typically they are, we know what the acceleration is because it's moving in a circle, find the missing force.
But you can still say that that acceleration caused the normal force?
No, I would say the normal force caused the acceleration. If that normal force weren't there, you wouldn't be accelerated. You'd go in a straight line. Right? If you have something that's on a string and the string breaks, it's going to go tangentially. It's the normal force that keeps pushing it around in the corner, just like that billiards. It's those forces that cause the path to be bent. Now, so usually, so one of the things that's tricky is usually the things that you don't know cause the things that you do know. And so you're kind of used to the causes being on the left-hand side of the equation and the effects being on the right-hand side of the equation. This isn't working that way. So it kind of looks like the acceleration is the cause of the force, but it's not. It's just that we've rearranged the equation because we know because acceleration is the thing that we're given.
Maybe just doing some examples would help.
Maybe not too, but yes, I have. I have another example to do. One that I would have liked to have done last time. It's I think it's problem 73 in the book. So in it. If you've ever picked up your luggage at an airport, you've probably noticed these devices. They're truncated cylinders, and your luggage comes out kind of like this, and this carousel, I want it to stick for the time being, this carousel carries it around so lots of people can get access to it. And usually this thing gets knocked down, and your suitcase ends up near the bottom of this cone. So this problem is asking us what's required for the luggage to stay put. What's required, how much friction is required for the luggage to actually stay in place. And these things aren't nearly as tilted as this cone. In fact, in this problem, it's tilted only by 20 degrees. So we have, so again, here's the axis of rotation. Here we have this thing that's just 20 degrees, and here's this piece of luggage. So what are the forces on it, right? We've got our list of forces. We can just go down the list, right? So there's going to be gravity, which always points straight down. There's a surface here, so there can be a normal force that's pushing that away. And you know that if this thing weren't rotating, there would have to be a frictional force which is pushing it up. And that's got to be the full list of forces, right? Because there aren't any springs attached, there aren't any strings attached. But there is an acceleration because this thing is going in a circle. So that's not a force, that's an acceleration. And it has to be caused by the sum of these forces.
So then why is it going directly to the left? Like,
because it goes towards the center of the circle that it's going in. So it's going in a horizontal circle like this, and the center of that is at altitude there, so it's going to be pointing right at the center. So in this sort of problem, we've got, you know, usually the first thing we're going to want to do after we've identified the forces is to set up a coordinate system. And we're again in that situation where half of the things are pointing on the tilted coordinate system and the other half of them are pointed on the kind of normal coordinate system. The problem is actually asking us for the frictional force. So I'm going to choose a coordinate system that is, I'll call this one X and this one, that's that has the frictional force in it, since that's what I want to calculate. So since two things are tilted, I'm going to have to write down their expressions in terms of these coordinate systems. And we've done that a lot for gravity, right? So you know that if this angle is 20 degrees, then that angle is 20 degrees. So this piece of gravity is going to be mg sine theta, and this piece of gravity is going to be mg cosine theta. Now we have to do the same thing for the acceleration. And I think if you think about it, that is equal to that same angle, right? Since this plus 20 degrees has to be 90 degrees, and this plus theta plus this angle has to be 90 degrees. So this kind of funny angle there has to be theta too. And we need to express this thing in terms of a piece that's in the x-axis and a piece that's in the y-axis. So in the y direction, the normal force is a positive force. This piece of gravity is in the negative direction, so that's minus mg cosine theta. And that has to equal this piece of the acceleration. And you can see that's in the negative y direction. And since it's opposite that angle, it's going to be sine. So it's going to be minus ma sine of theta. In terms of the x directions, we've got the frictional force. Gravity is pushing in the negative x direction. And this piece of the acceleration, it's adjacent to that angle theta. So it's equal, and it's in the positive x direction. So it's going to be ma cosine theta. Is that OK?
Can you just explain a little, like the
that angle stuff? Well, we need to break, since this thing isn't square with the x and y coordinates, we absolutely need to break it up into its x and y components. And that's going to involve trigonometry, so we have to figure out what that angle is. And I'm not sure what the best way of doing it. So here's gravity, here's the normal, and here's the acceleration. And we know, you know, from lots of problems that that angle is theta. And we can see that those two things are perpendicular, because one's horizontal and one's vertical. So theta plus phi has to be 90 degrees, but this is also 90 degrees. So phi plus theta tilde have to be 90 degrees, so theta tilde has to equal theta. And once we've done that, we can break this acceleration up into an x component and a minus y component. And so this y component is going to be sine because it's opposite that angle, and it's minus, and the other one's cosine. So we're all set to calculate the frictional force, right? The frictional force is going to be mg sine theta plus ma cosine theta. We know what g is. We know what the mass is. They tell us what the angle is. One thing that's a little bit tricky is the acceleration. Because in this particular problem, they didn't give us the velocity and they didn't give us the angular velocity. They gave us how long it takes this thing to make one full rotation. So if it takes 38 seconds to go around, and going around is 360 degrees, then the angular velocity is going to be 360 degrees divided by 38 seconds. But we really want that in radian measure, so we can use this equation. Remember, we can only do that if it's in radian. So omega is going to be a full rotation, which is 2 pi, divided by the 38 seconds. And so this acceleration then is going to be omega squared r, so 2 pi divided by 38 squared times the 7.46 meters. And then we know everything in that equation, we can calculate the frictional force. So they then go on to say that if the piece of luggage goes down a little bit the ramp, so now instead of being at 7.46 meters, it's at 7.94 meters, and the ramp picks up speed, so instead of taking 38 seconds to make a full revolution, it takes 34 seconds to make a full revolution. So we've increased omega. It's now 2 pi over 34, and we've increased r. It's now 7.94. We can again calculate the frictional force, and we can calculate the normal force. Right? So the normal force is going to be mg cosine theta minus ma sine theta. And remember that the coefficient of friction is the frictional force divided by the normal force. Right? So we just plug and chug. This is going to be mg sine theta plus ma cosine theta all over mg cosine theta minus ma sine theta. The mass of the luggage doesn't matter, it cancels out. So then we have all of those numbers. Okay. So name all your forces. Don't include any C word forces. Set the sum of the forces equal to the mass times the acceleration in each direction. And we're back to where we were with free body diagrams. More questions. So another homework problem had to do with the bat, right? The only way the bat is able to go into a circle is because it tilts its wings so that the lift force provides a force that's in the horizontal direction to cause the centripetal acceleration so it can go around in a circle. Meanwhile, of course, the same lift force has to be supporting it against gravity. Questions.
What does big G stand for?
We haven't gotten to it yet. It's left over from the last class.
Oh, okay. I was gonna say, it doesn't look like gravity.
It is gravity.
It's something else.
Other questions? Okay, so there's one last piece to this chapter, and kind of if you're keeping track, so we've got, after this chapter, we've got one more chapter, and then it's test time. So I think the test is like in 10 days, Thursday, and it'll be over the most recent four chapters. So we've got energy conservation, momentum conservation, this chapter, and then another chapter that's going to involve rotation. So I claim the hard part of this chapter, not because the equation's hard, but just because it's conceptually difficult, is this centripetal acceleration. So what's left in this chapter is gravity. And for some time, I've given you two equations for gravity. Near the surface of the Earth, the force of gravity is just mg. But we've said, but never really used, that if you're at great distance from the Earth, the force of gravity gets smaller according to your distance from the center of the Earth squared. So now we're going to start to use this equation and talk about, for example, orbits. Near the surface of the Earth, we said the gravitational potential energy was mgh. So we'd like to have a formula for gravitational potential energy that is more general, that would apply for any distance from the Earth. And remember, when we wrote down this formula, kind of the first thing you have to do is to define where the height is zero. So in a general problem, what are we going to mean by height zero? What are we going to take to be the zero for potential energy? And there just isn't any special spot, right? The surface of the Earth, we're looking for something that's universal, would apply to any planet. So what we're going to do is choose height equals zero to be at infinity. Sounds funny. And therefore, we're always below height equals zero. So we're always going to have negative potential energies. And the resulting formula, therefore, is going to have a minus sign in it. But otherwise, it's going to look very similar to the formula for the force, except we don't have r squared, we just have r. Incidentally, not uncommonly, people will write this equation with a minus sign to remind you that it's like a, kind of like a spring, it's an attractive force. So when we wrote the spring force, we had minus kx. If we followed the same logic for gravity, we should also write that as minus gm1 times m2 over r squared. But that's not done. But it is an attractive force. It's trying to pull things together.
So should we have the negative around?
Say again?
Should we have the negative sign for that equation or not?
So the book doesn't put a minus sign in. So you should know that it's an attractive force. Well, let's take a look at, of course, I have this capital G. Capital G is a universal constant. It can be written down in textbooks. It's written down in yours. And that is the numerical value for G, the so-called universal constant of gravitation. Yes, there are crazy units.
You don't care about them.
Well, so what do the units have to be? So the units have to make this equation work. So if you think about it, it has to be newtons per kilogram squared, because I need to cancel out those kilograms, times r squared meters squared up top. It's the only thing that's going to work. And not uncommonly, people write out that a newton is a kilogram meter per second squared. So what we're going to end up here is meters cubed per kilogram second squared. And generally speaking, I really think that units are important, but it is often kind of a mess to put down the units for capital G. And as long as you have everything in the proper MKS units, meters, kilograms, etc., then the units will work out with that value of G. So I'm not going to stress getting the units for capital G correct. Okay, so let's take a look at some of the homework problems. So the first problem has to do with calculating this force. So this force is omnipresent. So every two objects in the universe are attracted according to this equation. So in particular, billiard balls are attracted to each other, but because capital G is so small, the resulting force is tiny. And so that's kind of what we're doing here. So what we have is a 2 kilogram object that's at the origin, and right above it, on the y-axis, 2 units up, we've got a 3 kilogram object, and we've got a heavier object that's further away, that's at 4 units. And you should know that this guy is going to be attracted to the 4 kilograms, and it's going to be attracted to the 3 kilograms. So the net force is kind of pointing that way. And that's what we're supposed to do in this problem, figure out the angle and magnitude of that net force. So this X force, we can calculate. It's going to be G, the mass of the first object times the mass of the second object, divided by the distance between their centers squared. And this force here is going to be the G times the mass of the first object times the mass of the second object divided by their distance squared. So if I put these things together into their x and y components, the x component is G2 times 4 divided by 4 squared, and the y component is G2, 3 divided by 2 squared. And I don't know, I hate to calculate with small numbers twice, so I'm going to pull out those common factors. So I have 4 divided by 4 squared, which is just a quarter. And I have 3 divided by 4. So this vector is in that direction, this 1 quarter, 3 quarter direction, and it has a magnitude that I could calculate from the magnitude of the x and y components. So this is a vector, and I'm putting together the force in the x direction with the force in the y direction as an ordered pair, so that's a comma.
I was talking about the actual units, like in the parentheses, that's supposed to be g times 2 times 4, not...
Here. So there aren't any minus signs or parentheses. It's all multiplication.
Why isn't the x value 1/2 if you're multiplying or you're writing 8 divided by 16?
Because I also pulled out the 2. And why I bothered to pull out the 2, I'm not sure, but I did.
Oh. I thought
just to make it that much more interesting. Yeah, it's not g squared. You're never going to see g squareds. So this is a vector that is 1/4 in the x direction and 3 times further in the y direction, so it looks kind of like that. So I can get this angle, of course, by taking the inverse tangent of the opposite over the adjacent. So the inverse tangent of 3 not that. I have to see the keys on my calculator in order to press them properly. 71.6 degrees. So that's the angle, this angle, I don't know, choose your favorite angle. That angle of the force. And the magnitude of the force, of course, I can put that together with Pythagoras. It's the force in the x direction squared plus the force in the y direction squared. So here's the force in the x direction. There's the force in the y direction. All I need to do is to put them together. I'm going to use my magic button, of course, kind of no surprise. And I get 1.05 times 10 to the minus 10th newtons. And this is an example. I didn't bother to figure out those units. I knew that the force had to be in units of newtons.
And this is the force that's like right in the middle. Is that what we're finding?
Yeah, so this guy is being simultaneously attracted to the 3 and simultaneously attracted to the 4. So that net force is kind of like that. I think the problem asks for the angle too.
Oh, okay.
So it's not, they just say find the resultant gravitational force, but I think they wanted the angle and the magnitude.
Okay. What is the significance of the G2? I'm just confused because you had it and
No, it's still here.
I mean, it's still there, but it doesn't, we don't do anything else with it.
I needed it here.
How did you use it?
Because the x component is this and the y component is that. So I took this squared plus this squared and plugged it in there.
So you really didn't need to pull up that two. You could have just left it in there as g times the 2 times 4 times.
Yeah, I could have. Yep, I could have. But I actually just lied. I didn't do what I said. I actually did this. Basically, because I don't, what I said works just fine, but why deal with G twice when I can only deal with it once? But it works just, if you're happier doing it this way, this is just as good.
Yeah. So you took this, you did by the theorem and then times it by
G. Yeah. So if you write a vector as some number times another vector, then the magnitude of that vector, I hope it's clear, is just 5 times the magnitude of that other vector. So it's very easy to find the magnitude of 1 quarter, 3 quarters, and then I just multiplied the whole thing by g, 2g. But there's no reason to do that. You can do it like this just fine.
And then could you just, with the g2 and then the parentheses 1/4 and 3/4, like if you figure that out and like actually multiply them, can you just plug it into the button?
Yeah, that's in fact exactly what I did.
Okay.
I didn't. Yep. I hit. So this works just fine. But as a matter of fact, I put this in and hit the magic button, both to get the angle and the magnitude. More questions? Okay. So here we're shooting a projectile straight up, and the South Pole is only playing a role because we don't want to worry about the rotation of the Earth. So we're shooting straight up from a non-rotating Earth, and we're shooting at 1/3 the escape speed, and we're supposed to figure out how fast it's going. So that, of course, begs the question, what's the escape speed? So if I throw this piece of chalk up, it goes for a while up and then it comes down. And if, you know, fastball pitcher throws something up, it's still going to come down. But the harder you throw it, the further it's going to go. And you can imagine that there's some speed that you could throw something at which would not come back because the force of gravity is getting smaller all the time. Maybe it would be insufficient in order to reverse the motion. So this is something we can calculate using energy conservation. So if we look at the initial potential energy sitting here at the surface of the Earth, we have g mass of the Earth times mass of the rock we're throwing, and we're pretty much at the radius of the Earth, right? Unless we're on some mountaintop. And the kinetic energy, well, we don't know how fast we're throwing it to. In fact, that's what we're supposed to find. So the velocity is an unknown. So this is all the initial state. In the final state, I'm going to be at infinity, so my potential energy is going to be minus gmm over infinity. And if you got a huge number in the denominator, that's zero. And the kinetic energy, well, the minimum amount of kinetic energy I could have would be zero, right? I might throw it harder so that it's moving even at infinity, but the least amount of kinetic energy I can have is zero. So the final total energy, oddly enough, is going to be zero. The initial energy is the sum of these two. So 1/2 mv² minus gmm over the radius of the Earth. The initial energy has to equal the final energy. Right, so we have some large amount of kinetic energy, some large negative amount of gravitational potential energy, and we're trying to reach height zero, which is at infinity. So if I rearrange this guy a little bit, notice that the mass that I'm throwing doesn't matter, and the speed that's required, square root of 2gm over the radius of the Earth. So if I plug and chug, 2 times g, 6.67 times 10 to the minus 11, I need the mass of the Earth, and that's in this table in the back of the book, basically 6 times 10 to the 24th kilograms, 5.98 times 10 to the 24th, the radius of the Earth is about 6,370 kilometers, so that's 6.38 is what the book likes, times 10 to the 6th meters. So if I...
Wait, so what's the big M is... So you're given G as a constant, and the big M is what?
So the big M is the thing that's attracting this chalk back.
And that's the weight of it?
No, that's the weight of the Earth.
Yeah, the weight of what's attracting...
This piece of chalk.
Yeah.
Which is the Earth. Okay? Okay, so plug in chug, we got 6.67, 10 to the minus 11th, 5.98, 10 to the 24th, 2, and 6.38, 10 to the 6th. Take the square root of it all, and I get 1.12 times 10 to the 4th meters per second, 10,000 meters per second. 10 kilometers per second. It's kind of nice to know what that is in miles per hour, because that's what we're more interested in. So you might remember that in 1 mile, there's 1609, I think, meters. And in an hour, there are 3,600 seconds. So I multiply by 3,600, divide by 1609. And I got pretty much exactly 25,000 miles per hour. Okay, so a lot faster than your car can go. So in this particular problem, we're not throwing it up with an escape velocity, we're throwing it up with a third of the escape velocity. And so it's not going to escape, right? It's going to go up and it's going to come down again. But we can work it the same sort of way. In the initial state, we have potential energy that all comes from the fact that we're sitting on the surface of the Earth, one radius away from the center of the Earth. So we have a potential energy that's minus gm over the radius of the Earth. We have a kinetic energy that comes from having a velocity that is one-third of that. Right, so this is the escape velocity, one-third of the escape velocity. This is the kinetic energy. We can simplify this a little bit because we have a square root squared. So we have a 2 and a 2 that'll cancel, the 3 will become a 9, and all of the square root stuff will be avoided. So that's what our kinetic energy is. Yes?
Why is that the escape speed and not the initial speed? Didn't we solve for the initial speed?
So it says that the initial speed is one-third of the escape velocity. And we're trying to find how high it goes.
Why is it 2gm on the left side and gm, g capital M, little m on the right? When you squared the entire thing there. Oh.
So this is a 2, that's the escape velocity.
Oh, and then it's divided by 2 times m. Gotcha, sorry.
So the total initial energy, just the sum of these two, so it's minus GMM over R plus 1/9 of that. So minus 1 plus 1/9 is going to be minus 8/9. So this was all in the initial state. In the final state, by that I mean when we reach this peak, the potential energy will depend on how high we are, and that's what we're trying to find. And at this spot, I've stopped instantaneously, right? I've reached a maximum, and now I'm going to head down. So my kinetic energy is going to be zero. So I start with a mix of kinetic energy and potential energy. I end up with just potential energy. And my total energy, just the sum of these two, is minus GMM over the unknown height that I reach. So initial energy needs to equal final energy. And notice there's a huge cancellation, right? The minus sign, all of that numerator goes away. So I've got 1 over R is equal to 8/9 of 1 over capital R. This is lowercase r. And if I rearrange that, bring this up, yeah, so I get r times 8/9 is r. Yes, I like that.
What is the difference between the top, what were we solving for the top one, and now what are we solving for this one? Like, what's the difference?
So the top was the escape velocity. We're trying to figure out how fast you need to go in order to not come back. And we found out for the Earth it was like 25,000 miles an hour. The problem says, what happens if you throw something up not with the escape velocity, but with only 1/3 the escape velocity? So since it's less than the escape velocity, it's going to go up and come down. And they're asking, how high does it go?
What's little r again?
So capital R is the radius of the Earth. Little r is how high.
Gotcha.
So usually we measure heights above the Earth. And that's, of course, little r minus capital R. So it's going to be 1/8 of capital R. So we've got our 6,300, and the book likes 80 for our radius of the Earth. We divide that by 8, and we are 798 kilometers high, which is way higher than the astronauts are, for example. Astronauts are maybe 200 kilometers up. Are we happy? Not really. So what about those astronauts? What's the story about them? So they are going around in a circle, so they have a centripetal acceleration. There aren't any springs attached, there aren't any strings attached, so there isn't any surface, so the only force acting on them is gravity. So if they're going around in a circle, that it has radius lowercase r, which is maybe 200 kilometers more than capital R, then we know that the only force acting on them is gravity, and that they are going around in a circle, and so they have a centripetal acceleration. So the acceleration that gravity causes has to be F equals ma. So notice that the mass cancels out. Doesn't matter what's orbiting, it's still going to have the same orbital speed. So the velocity it takes to orbit is going to be the square root of gm over r. And as I say, their distance is pretty much the same as the radius of the Earth.
So then that 9/8, or how did you get 1/8 r? Like, what happened there from the 9/8 r?
So this was the distance from the center of the Earth, but usually we measure altitudes from the surface of the Earth. So in order to get what you would usually call height, I need to subtract the radius of the Earth from lowercase r. So this thing here was 9/8. And 1 minus 9/8 is 1/8. That happened pretty fast. Okay, so orbital velocity is just the 25,000 miles an hour divided by the square root of 2. And so it turns out to be about 17,000 miles an hour. So historically, World War II, the Nazis were firing rockets at Britain, right? And they actually went to these sorts of heights, higher than the astronauts are orbiting. But they weren't able to orbit an astronaut, right? We had to wait until 1957 for the Russians to put the first Sputnik up in space. And that's because it takes a lot more speed, right? 17,000 miles an hour as opposed to 8,000 miles an hour in order to orbit. And similarly, the time lag between when the Russians orbited a satellite and when the Russians hit the moon was pretty small, because you didn't have to go that much faster, right? You only had to go square root of 2 faster in order to hit the moon than to just orbit the Earth. So a relatively short, huge time lag between hitting Britain from Germany to when we orbited, but then a relatively short time lag between when we hit the moon and hit Mars. Those sorts of things didn't require that much more velocity than just to orbit. And it might be worth stressing that we're kind of fooled by watching what happens at Cape Canaveral, right? We see the rocket go up, and so we usually think that that's mostly what's required. And that is what the Nazis did, right? What goes up comes down. In order to orbit, you have to turn your rocket sideways and spend almost all of your fuel going sideways fast in order to get up to that orbital velocity of basically 18,000 miles an hour. Incidentally, you don't have to work that hard to slow down because of friction, right? If you just slow down enough so that you intersect with the Earth's atmosphere, then you can provide a big force to slow you down. It's speeding up that's expensive. There's a big confusion about orbiting that's represented in an iQuiz question. I'm not sure we have to do it as an iQuiz question, but let's present it now. Okay, so we say that astronauts are weightless. Why? Not fooling as many people as I did the first class. I just couldn't read it. Well, it can't be A, right? Because there is no range of gravity, right? Gravity does get smaller and smaller and smaller, but it's always there. We know that the C word is not an answer to any question in this course. And we know that she's going in a circle, so she's certainly accelerating. So it has to be D. So this is all back to the Galileo experiment, right? We have a heavy object, the space shuttle, and we have the astronaut. And they're falling together. And so they seem to be floating one inside the other. So it may seem funny, but the space shuttle is always falling. It's falling 100% of the time. Why doesn't it hit the Earth? Well, because the Earth is curved, right? So here's the space shuttle. If there were no force on it, it would go in a straight line. But it's falling. But it's falling just enough so it keeps the same altitude over the curved Earth. So you might know that NASA has an aircraft they call the Vomit Comet, and it's used to simulate weightlessness. And it works perfectly easily, right? So all that does, the airplane goes as high as it can, and then it turns off its engines, and it falls. So the people inside in the airplane all fall together, and it's exactly like being in the space shuttle. Everything's falling. Now, it's not going fast sideways, so you better turn on your engines after about a minute so that you can regain your altitude. Right? So you can simulate weightlessness just fine. Just go into an elevator and cut the cable, and it works great. I haven't tried it myself, but you could give me a video recording of what it's like. You won't be able to tell me afterwards. Okay, so orbit just requires going sideways fast. Going up is relatively easy. Well, so I'm kind of running out of time. Let me give you some important brief information about orbits. So historically, why did anyone believe Newton? Right, because Newton's laws kind of require you to be experimenting in this frictionless surface, and they just don't exist on Earth. Right, so Newton says that if you apply no force, you go forever in a straight line. Well, you just never see that. What you see is what Aristotle talked about, where things slow down and come to rest if they're started up. So historically, the important evidence for Newtonian mechanics was the motion of planets. Right? They work in a pretty frictionless environment, and they should satisfy Newton's laws. And it turns out that people had spent a great deal of time studying the motion of the planets for bad reasons, to make horoscopes. But famously, around 1570, a guy named Tycho Brahe spent 20 years making very accurate observations of the locations of the planets. He didn't have a telescope. This is before telescopes. But he did an extraordinary job of measuring as accurately as possible the location of the planets. He gave his data to Kepler. And Kepler derived what the motions of the planets were, not by mathematics, but by these observations. And Kepler discovered three systematic trends of the motions of the planets. So first of all, the motions of the planets are not circles, which is what the Greeks taught, right? The heavens had to be perfect, and nothing's more perfect than a circle, therefore the planets move in circles, was the syllogism. But in fact, the motions of planets are in this squashed circle that's called an ellipse. And the sun isn't at the center of this ellipse, it's at a focus of the ellipse. The second law he found was really surprising. And the oddness of the law, I think, tells you how hard he had to work in order to find this relationship. So Kepler asked himself, if I look, compare the location of a planet from day to day, and I calculate the area of this kind of skinny triangle, I find that it's the same every day. So it doesn't matter whether the planet is here or whether the planet is there. Every day, the planet sweeps out the same amount of area. So that's a really weird law. These days, we would say that the radius squared times the angular velocity is a constant. It turns out that that's the same thing as this funny aerial law. So this has to do with the fact that when a planet is close to the sun, it's moving faster than when it's far from the sun. Incidentally, there are names for this location. This is called the perigee, or excuse me, the perihelion, and this far distance point is called the aphelion. If we were talking about going around the Earth, that would be perigee and apogee as opposed to helion. So what you go around is in the name. So what he found was that if you take basically the big radius of this ellipse, which is called the semi-major axis, as opposed to this, which is the semi-minor axis, if you take the semi-major axis and cube it and put that underneath the time it takes to go around the sun squared, this is the same for every planet. So if you look at the moons of Jupiter, which was done soon thereafter, you look at how long they take to go around Jupiter, what their semi-major axis is, it's the same for all of the moons of Jupiter. Okay, so quitting time.